I think we'll get started. I didn't see anybody lingering out in the fellowship hall. My name is Don Bacher, and I'm the current president of the Pacific Northwest Mennonite Historical Society, and it's my pleasure to welcome each of you here this afternoon for our annual meeting presentation. Just a quick, well, I don't have to tell you to move forward because you've already done that. I appreciate that. Thank you. We are honored this afternoon to have our guest speaker with us. In August of 1975, Judy and I and our children began a two-year assignment with Mennonite Central Committee in Jamaica. Upon arriving in Kingston, one of the first families that we met were Stan and Marlene Krupp. They were stationed in Kingston and lived in the little cottage behind the MCC headquarters. Judy was acquainted with Stan and Marlene as they were fellow Oregonians from God's country. But it was my first connection with the two of them. During the next 12 months, I came to appreciate Stan and Marlene as a couple and as individuals for the many skills and abilities that they provided to the Jamaican MCC unit. One of the highlights for me that first year was being able to sing with them at unit gatherings, and Stan and I were part of a men's quartet, and that was a lot of fun. Today, we're privileged to have them here as part of our annual meeting. I don't want to spoil Marlene's thunder by telling you any stories about her and Stan and her family, but I will tell you that Marlene is an ordained Mennonite minister. She's a retreat leader and spiritual director who has retired to Port Townsend, Washington. And she'll tell you in her talk, if you haven't already found out, why they're in Port Townsend and not in Oregon. As I indicated, she's an Oregonian, having grown up in the Willamette Valley. She moved to Indiana in 1983 and returned to the Pacific Northwest in 2012. She's Professor Emerita of Spiritual Formation and Worship at Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary in Elkhart, and served as Minister of Worship and Spirituality with Mennonite Church USA for nearly 25 years. During the past two decades, she has led 8 pilgrimages to Celtic lands. She and Stan still enjoy singing and are part of a community chorus. They love hiking on nearby trails, sailing on Discovery Bay, and Discovery Bay is in Jamaica as well, gardening, cooking, and hosting guests. They are parents of 2 adult children, Jeremy and his wife Valerie, who live near Chicago, and Heather, who lives near Pittsburgh. Marlene is co-author of Praying with the Anabaptist, The Secret of Bearing Fruit, a Faith and Life Press publication, 1994, and Singing a Mennonite Voice, a Herald Press, 2001. She's co-editor of An Open Place, the Ministry of Group Spiritual Direction, Morehouse, 2012, and co-authored Preparing Sunday Dinner, A Collaborative Approach to Worship and Preaching, another Herald Press, 2005. Following Marlene's presentation, we'll take a few minutes and allow you to ask questions. Welcome, Marlene. It's good to have you and Stan with us.
Is that about right? You can hear me if I speak there. We did have an enjoyable time at lunch today, remembering a few things about Jamaica, about our time together there with the Bacher family, and seeing many of you here whom I've known in years past in Oregon makes me want to tell stories about those various connections. But if I did that, I would far exceed the time that has been suggested. So, full circle. When I was asked to choose a title for today's talk, I had no idea what I would want to say. And so Full Circle was an obvious choice, not a subtle one. As Don has mentioned, I spent most of the first 40 years of my life in Oregon, and then left behind the people and the places that I dearly loved here for 29 years. The conventional wisdom is you can't go home again. But there was never a question about returning for us. We always knew that that's what we hoped we could do. And living in the eastern half of the United States did nothing to change that intention. But during the past month, I've been looking beneath the surface, trying to understand more fully what home has meant to me, specifically my Oregon home, and why it was so important to me to return. I'll begin by reading a couple of paragraphs from a chapter I wrote in a book about 20 years ago, She Has Done a Good Thing, Mennonite Women Leaders Tell Their Stories. I recently traveled to Oregon for a family reunion and took a side trip to Willamina, the small town of less than 2,000 in the foothills of the Coast Mountains where I grew up. As I drove through the streets, I wondered again, how did the pigtailed little girl get from here to churchwide ministry? In this rough and tumble logging town, my classmates at Willamina Grade School were lucky even to graduate from high school. Few went to college. The congregation in which I grew up did not support higher education. Even my parents were ambivalent. Though they were strongly supportive of Mennonite secondary education and made sure I attended a Mennonite high school, they did not consider it a priority for young women to attend college. I had to beg them to let me go to Eastern Mennonite College in Harrisonburg, Virginia, where I stayed for 1 year, and then I returned to Oregon to complete my college education at a state school. Even now, I find it hard to pinpoint precisely what pushed me out of the nest of comfortable expectations and on to a less traveled way. What I do know is that I always wanted to become a teacher. What I didn't know was that such a vocation would call me away from my beloved valley and make me a leader in the church. On both sides of my family, both the Nice clan and the Wolfer clan, I'm descended from people who were Anabaptist Mennonites for hundreds of years. My father's family was part of the Germantown Mennonite Church, the first Mennonite congregation in the New World, established in 1708. On my mother's side, our Mennonite ancestry goes back to the 1600s or earlier in Switzerland, and from there to southern Germany and eventually to Russia. That story is told in this book, For His Sake, by Mildred Schrock. And there may be some others of you here today who are descendants of that line. I'm intrigued by the fact, however, that both of my grandparents married outside of the Mennonite Church. My father's mother was of British and Irish descent, probably Celtic. And my mother's father, a Wolfer, was of German Pietist descent, people who established a utopian community not very far from here in Aurora in 1856, 3 years before Oregon became a state. All of which is to say that my Mennonite ancestry and my Oregon ancestry are long and deep, and so it's no surprise that these are strong loyalties. I'm the eldest child of Howard and Luella Wolfer Nice, couple of you asked me that question today. I was born in McMinnville, Oregon, and I have five younger siblings, one of whom is deceased, as are both of my parents. I'm the only child in my family who is a member of an MCUSA congregation today, although two of my brothers are pastors of Mennonite churches. Richard Rohr, a Franciscan priest, has given me a framework for understanding my life journey when he writes about the spirituality of the two halves of life. And when I look back, I can see the two halves very clearly. He says that in the first half of life, we build a sturdy container for our identity with boundaries and expectations and inherited ways of looking at things. And if we're fortunate, that foundation is healthy and strong and it serves us well. The container is not an end in itself, but it gets us started on the way. And so I'm deeply grateful to Sheridan Mennonite Church for the sturdy container it provided for my faith. Is there anyone else here who grew up at Sheridan? I had thought Pat Hirschberger might be here today. She's also from Sheridan, but she's attending a funeral. It was a warm-hearted faith at Sheridan. It emphasized scripture and daily discipleship. And not everything was positive, and I'll tell a story about one of those tensions in a bit. But in the main, I was blessed by being part of that congregation. Some of us who grew up in that congregation planned a two-day reunion in 2000 to celebrate the gifts we had received and to say thank you to those people who were still there. One of the greatest gifts that I received from that congregation was the vibrant singing tradition. We loved to sing together. And at the Saturday night hymn sing on that reunion weekend, I read a chapter from my doctoral dissertation called Love Song for the Church on Madison Street. And some of that material was later included in this book, Singing a Mennonite Voice, that I co-authored with Ken Nafziger. In my memory, the hymn we often sang first was a 19th century text and tune by Robert Lowry, O Worship the Lord. The first chord on the word O was always held for a dramatic moment before we moved on to sing the rest of the hymn. Women's voices, clear and soaring, sang a duet in the middle of each stanza. And then the male voices joined them in the vigorous refrain, O glory, hallelujah. And when the song was finished and the last notes hung in the air, the presence of God was palpable. Holiness was everywhere, mingling with the sunlight that danced above us. A huge pillar of my formation in that church was summer Bible school. Every summer, 250 children or more gathered for 2 weeks to learn and pray and play and sing together. And every year, the women of the congregation spent many hours hand-painting a scripture motto for each child in the Bible school. And every year, we looked forward to getting an even bigger motto. And you can imagine what the walls of our homes looked like as one after another of these mottos found a place on the wall. We children thought they were gorgeous. And I'm sorry that I don't still have one of those mottos. But I do have one memento from those years. 1 year I got a prize for learning a prescribed number of Bible verses. This tiny little motto, which now hangs in my study and has hung in every home I've lived in ever since, which says, God is love. And that's perhaps the greatest gift that I received from that congregation. When I was 15, I was thrilled to be invited to teach a class of a dozen first graders in Bible school. And this, I think, is what was the genius of the Sheridan Mennonite Church. While I was growing up, one of my best friends was Shirley Yoder Brubaker, former pastor of Parkview Mennonite Church in Harrisonburg, Virginia. When she and I get together and reflect on where our paths have gone, we chuckle and we say, they did it all wrong at Sheridan if they didn't want us to end up where we are. Our congregation was truly Anabaptist in calling everyone to become a disciple, follow Christ, and serve as a functioning member of the Christian community. Shirley and I simply believed what we were told and acted on it. The underside of this story is the patriarchal mindset that dominated that congregation. But there was an interesting ambivalence. We were taught that women must be subordinate to men, yet in the congregation, women exercised a great deal of vigorous leadership. And so it's not surprising that when an impressionable young woman receives two conflicting messages, she hears the one that is life-giving. As young girls, we were required to dress differently than the girls around us. Boys didn't have to dress differently, only girls. One of the rules was that we had to wear long brown stockings to cover our legs. It was a matter of modesty. Even little baby girls wore white long stockings, while little boy babies were bare-legged and wore short socks. And like other young girls, I chafed under that restriction. We had to wear an awkward elastic apparatus called supporters or a garter belt to hold up our long brown stockings. Some of you recognize that piece of equipment? On warm days, these stockings were miserable. So when we got out of sight of home, we rolled our stockings down and we walked around with these fat rolls hugging our ankles. To say we were embarrassed by this peculiar garb would be an understatement. I remember having a conversation one day while I walked home from school with a friend, and she asked me, why do you wear those long brown stockings? And I lied, and I said, it's because I have rheumatism. And I've never confessed that lie publicly before. When I was in the seventh grade, the ban on short socks was suddenly lifted. What we heard later by the grapevine was that the bishop's granddaughters had been complaining about the long brown stockings, and that somehow turned the tide, and we were now permitted to wear anklets. My mother must have disliked that restriction every bit as much as we did, because immediately she went to town and bought us anklets and brought them home for my sister and me to wear. So on Monday morning, I wore my new anklets to school along with a can-can under my full skirt. That was the style back then. And the news quickly spread all over school. Marlene is wearing a can-can and anklets. And they probably wondered if I'd be cutting my hair next. But that didn't happen for another 20 years until after my grandmother died, and I was pretty sure she wouldn't care in heaven. I moved away from that community as a young adult. I think I knew instinctively that it wouldn't be a good place as a grown-up because I had already received the best gifts that community had to offer. Some of my peers who left became angry and bitter, and I never did. And I'm not sure why, except that there were two things I always knew. The faith of my elders was genuine. It was authentic. And they loved us children. And nothing we could ever do would change that. except Grandma would tell you what she thought about what you were doing. There was another strong and healthy formative influence, and that was Western Mennonite School. At last, there, I could be with peers who shared the same spiritual values I had, and that's hugely important to an adolescent. We had wonderful, gifted teachers, some of whom are here today. They took an interest in each of us. I became a high school English teacher because of one of them. And I met Stan at Western, the companion who has enriched my life and supported me all these years, now in excess of 50. Here's one small incident from a Bible class at Western. Even in such a nurturing environment as Western, however, I became aware of the potential for injustice in the church. I recall the chagrin of Marcus Lind, our Bible teacher, when he had to allow young women to present their biblical exposition papers in chapel. In our school tradition, the two best papers in the class would be presented as chapel addresses. Apparently, up until that year, it had always been young men who were awarded the honor. In our class, my paper, along with that of another young woman, earned the highest marks. I still remember Marcus squirming and insisting that somehow this wasn't right. But he was a fair man. We gave the addresses. Stanley and I married in 1964, 2 days after I finished my BA degree. When I looked around, I observed then that most women who married before finishing college never had the opportunity to earn their degrees. I was determined not to be one of them, and so I went to summer school and I finished college in 3 years instead of 4, so we could get married sooner. There was another powerful shaping influence, and that was our move to Portland, Oregon, as young adults. The stimulating environment of Portland Mennonite Church, an urban setting, a congregation that nurtured the leadership gifts of young adults. But here we approach the second half of life. What normally happens toward midlife is that the sturdy box that we built so carefully in the first half of life begins to bend and buckle and then collapse. And if we're to thrive spiritually, we have to let that container go and discover the contents for which the container was intended. And at first, that feels like a loss of faith. It feels like death. But eventually, if we remain open to the Spirit's work, it becomes a resurrection. But that can take a very long time. And the latter years we spent at Portland Mennonite Church and the years we served with MCC in Jamaica were part of that gradual disintegration, that breaking up, even though there were many wonderful things happening at the same time. It was the 60s when we came to Portland Mennonite Church. We participated in lively conversations during those years, and some of you were part of those, conversations about Christian feminism, the role of science and faith, political action, intentional Christian community, and God is dead theology. My intellectual constructs of faith were seriously stretched and reshaped during that time. And it was during those years that I discovered the writings of Julian of Norwich, a 14th century English mystic, and found healing and repair for some of the distorted theology that was no longer serving me well. And then came Jamaica. Before we ended our term with MCC, I entered a dark night of the soul. I think it was from the accumulated weight of senseless violence and poverty and pain, along with the growing awareness that God doesn't intervene to save the innocent, that shattered my faith, especially a faith in a caring and protecting God. And in the midst of those struggles, and losses, I searched for spiritual answers. And in one of those decisions, for which I'll be forever grateful, the women's organization of the Mennonite Church chose to send Mary Herr across the U.S. and Canada to lead contemplative retreats. And for me, it was a second conversion when the scales fell from my eyes. My childhood faith had instructed me well about God, but it really hadn't given me tools and practices for nurturing an adult relationship with God, particularly an intimate relationship with God. And in that weekend of silence, I met a loving and welcoming God whom I'd only ever had glimpses of before, and learned a path for sustaining that relationship. Eventually, that spiritual search led me to seminary study at AMBS and our move to Elkhart, Indiana in 1983. And there I worked, as Don said, in the Office of Worship and Spirituality for the Mennonite Church for nearly 30 years, and at the same time taught about half-time at AMBS for 26 years. But getting there was difficult. I did not want to leave Oregon. Like many Westerners, I harbored a healthy dose of skepticism toward any institution east of the Mississippi. When I admitted that prejudice to an old friend on the staff at Eastern Mennonite College, who happens to be here today, she replied, "You won't be any good working in a church office unless you are skeptical." And that gave me courage to respond to that call. And so, after several months of discernment and prayer, I said no to the call. The timing didn't seem right. Leaving Oregon would be too painful. Because the decision had been so long and painful in coming, Stan and I simply didn't talk about it again once we gave a negative answer. My heart, however, remained unsettled. A couple of months went by. Then one day, Stan came home from work and blurted out, "I think we made the wrong decision." I replied, "Oh, no, I don't want to hear another word." And I left the room in tears. So we did nothing. Some months later, Stanley received an invitation to apply for a new position in finance with the Mennonite Church General Board. The next morning, I called Gordon Zook, Executive Secretary at Mennonite Board of Congregational Ministries, and I asked, "Is the job still open that was offered to me?" Gordon said, "Yes." And just last night, I took a walk with my wife, Bonnie, and I told her, "I wish Marlene Krupp would call me in the morning and tell me she has changed her mind." 2 months later, I left Oregon with our two children, Jeremy, who was 14, and Heather, who was 11, and drove across the country to Indiana. I cried off and on most of the way to the state line. 5 weeks later, Stan joined us after he sold our house and his business, and he began a new job with the Mennonite Church General Board. Even though we sometimes refer to our years in the Midwest as exile or other unflattering terms, it was a very fruitful and creative time for me professionally. But everything I had ever learned or experienced here in the far West served me well in denominational leadership. During one of my first weeks in the Mennonite offices, Willard Roth invited me to join him for a conversation. He worked in another office there. Later, Willard became a dear friend, and he and I led many Celtic pilgrimages together. What Willard told me that day was, "You've been called to lead the Mennonite Church. You can fill in the slots doing what your predecessor has done, or you can seek out a vision for the future." And I was challenged by that congregation. What should such a vision be, or what could it be? And so from my denominational office, I watched and I listened and I made some troubling observations about the Mennonite church, the larger church. In worship, there was too little scripture and too little prayer. We were content to talk about God, but we were reluctant to encounter God personally and corporately. The absence of the arts in worship kept many doors closed to encounter with God, and our fear of ritual kept other doors closed. In terms of personal spiritual formation, we weren't teaching people to pray, nor were we offering an adequate path of spiritual formation, an intentional, sustained process for growing our faith in a secular, postmodern world. So where would we look for guidance, and how might the Spirit be calling us? Being at AMBS, first as a student and then as a professor, was a huge gift because it steeped me in Anabaptist theology and practice. But because of my growing interest in Christian worship and spirituality, I also studied nearby at the University of Notre Dame, a Catholic institution. There were simply not courses being offered at AMBS in those on those topics at that time. What it fell to me to do was to weave together the strengths of both of these strands of the Christian tradition. The longer history and practice of spiritual and worship in the universal Christian church, and the unique emphases of the Anabaptist tradition. It was a serendipitous time. I've always said I was so lucky, so fortunate to be where I was at that particular time, because what I most longed for personally and in the church was a renewal of our spirituality and worship. But that's also what many other people were longing for and hoping for. And so I found many wonderful collaborators along the way. And one part of that vision emerged from this Mennonite-Catholic intersection. Praying with the Anabaptists, The Secret of Bearing Fruit, is a little book that I co-authored that holds together the contemplative prayer practices of the ancient Christian church with the stories and letters and prayers of the Anabaptist martyrs. Another gift from that intersection is Bridge Folk. Many Mennonites were being drawn to the spirituality and the sacraments of the Catholic monastic tradition. I think it's important to notice that it wasn't an attraction to the Catholic Church per se, but to the monastic tradition, which had preserved these traditions. These were areas where Anabaptists have historically been underdeveloped. And at the same time, Catholics were being attracted to the peace and discipleship emphases of the Anabaptist tradition. So here you have these two groups of people looking at each other from afar and remembering the ancient enmity. And the question was, how could we get these people together to become friends and talk to each other and share these rich gifts? And in an amazing series of developments, which I still marvel at, Bridge Folk was born. And I have permission to let you in on a tiny secret today, which is that plans are just beginning for Bridge Folk to meet in the Seattle area in late July in 2017, the annual gathering that brings peace-minded Catholics and spirituality-minded Mennonites together for common conversation. It's the first time the gathering has come west, might never happen again, and I hope that many of you will be able to participate. Another part of this vision that I began to see was the importance of introducing spiritual direction to the Mennonite church. 30 years ago, we could count on one hand the number of trained spiritual directors in our church, and today there are several hundred. The one with one ministry of these people has been significant, but I think far more significant has been the way spiritual direction has provided leaven in the larger church for an awakening to spiritual practices. Church councils, committees, and even the convention delegate assembly now pause to listen to the Spirit, to dwell in the Word, and bring our worship and our work closer together. Thanks be to God. Another part of the vision, and this one I could talk a lot about and don't have time today, was the rediscovery of the resonance between Celtic spirituality and the Anabaptist tradition. For some of us, the Celtic tradition has revived and renewed some emphases that were lost or discarded in the Anabaptist church. And the beautiful and poetic prayers and songs of the Celtic tradition are something the Anabaptist tradition never had. We never had anything like the beauty of that resource. And so, Don, you mentioned the Celtic pilgrimages. Stan and I are planning to lead our last Celtic pilgrimage this coming summer to places in Scotland, Ireland, and England to acquaint people, introduce people to the richness of this tradition. Another part of the vision I was given to share involved creating new worship resources for the church, seasonal resources in Leader Magazine, Minister's Manual, Hymnal, and supplements that came. When I hear congregations sing a song like "Nothing is lost on the breath of God," as though they've known it all their lives, or when I hear children and young people singing we will follow Jesus, and I know that they've only had that song in the repertoire for a scant 7 or maybe 8 years, then I know that something truly remarkable and soul-shaping happens when thoughtfully discerned worship resources are provided for the church. I only have time for one story about that process. After the hymnal committee for Hymnal, a Worship Book had completed their work assembling those resources, there was a group of 4 of us plus a couple of publishing executives who were appointed to cut 100 songs from the collection. We had too many songs. You'd have a book that nobody could lift in church if we included them all. We met in San Francisco to do that work of cutting, since the managing editor of the project lived there. And we had nearly finished, and we kept asking ourselves, have we included all that the church needs to sing? And it was during the early days of the first Iraq war. Our hearts were heavy with despair. We looked through our collection from which we were supposed to be cutting songs, and we felt we had no song to sing, no lament to adequately express our sorrow over this unfolding tragedy. One evening we went out to eat supper and we stopped at a music shop in Berkeley afterward. And we were browsing through the recordings there and someone bought one recorded by Chanticleer, a famous San Francisco men's choir. And the next morning for our opening prayer, someone put it on for us to hear. We listened to one of the songs and then we listened to another and another. And all of a sudden everything got very quiet. We were listening to "We Shall Walk Through the Valley in Peace." We looked at each other and we began nodding our heads. And we said, "That's it. That's the song we need yet." And we all knew it. And so this afternoon, I've invited Stan to lead us in singing this hymn, which was the Spirit's gift to a hard-working committee that day and has been a gift to the church. It's 412 in Hymnal, a Worship Book.
Hymn 412. you'll notice that the melody begins with the bass and tenor in the first score, and then it shifts to the soprano line for the next two full scores and beginning in the last one, and then migrates to the altos. So that's the way the song goes through. And the last verse, of course, is just the humming. So let's stand together and sing. I will follow the melody line even though it jumps around.
This talk is called Full Circle, so it's time to complete the circle. When retirement loomed ahead, we knew we wanted to return to the West, but when and where were the questions. It would be hard to love the people we had come to, or to leave the people we had come to love dearly in Elkhart Goshen community, and I knew it would be very hard for me to leave the work that I loved, which had been so nourishing. But whenever we got quiet for a moment and looked within, we knew the dream of going back home was still alive and strong. We had vacationed often in Port Townsend through the years. It's a historic Victorian seaport town on the Olympic Peninsula. We liked the coastal environment, the bays and the forests, and especially the rain shadow. But we knew not a single soul there. A call from God and the church had lured us to Elkhart County, where we didn't know anybody either. And so we wondered, would there be another call at this stage of our lives? What we did know was that this next chapter wouldn't be so much about doing as about being. So one summer, we were again visiting Port Townsend, seeking to discern whether or not this town should become our retirement home. And on Sunday, we visited a church where the minister preached from Luke 10, 1 to 11. As she opened the text in which Jesus sent 70 disciples out into the villages he intended to visit, she emphasized that the center of their call was to offer peace and blessing wherever they went. She quoted an old Aramaic blessing, which is likely the source of Jesus' words that he gave to those disciples. He said to them, "Say peace to this house." And she said that comes from a longer Aramaic blessing, which is on this piece here. "Peace be to this house and family. May it complete its purpose and tell its tale to the end. May it fulfill itself in surrender to the One." And both of us sensed immediately that this was the direction we had been waiting for. We were being called for nothing other than to offer peace and blessing in this community. And so after we built our cottage, one of the first things we did was commission a dear friend to write the blessing, and it hangs beside our front door so that we can see it every time we open that door to greet someone. God has called us here to offer a blessing of peace. Some days it's still hard to believe that we're here. I can't imagine a more wonderful place to be. And so I'm profoundly grateful to be home again. And I'm grateful to all of you for listening to my story today. Don asked me to bring some books, which are going to be out here somewhere afterward, and said if I had any to sell, I should bring those. And I found a couple of extra copies of one of them. The rest are not extra copies. And so if there's someone who wants one of those, you can pick it up afterward, and I'll be glad to respond to questions. Are you going to do that?
Thank you, Marlene. Okay, it's your turn. Are there questions you have for Marlene that she didn't happen to cover in her talk? Say who you are, just for her sake.
Leroy Chubb. Marlene, thank you so much. My question is, part of the end of your story is that you and Stan have become re-members of the Portland Mennonite Church. Why?
Well, you can't take the Mennonite out of us. Obviously, we're too far from a Mennonite congregation where we live to be a regular participant. And so we do worship in a local congregation, a wonderful, wacky little church, just like much of Port Townsend is kind of wacky and weird, but we like it that way. One of the things that's wacky is these people didn't grow up knowing Scripture as well as we did. So when they hear four texts read in church on Sunday morning, some of them are hearing them for the first time, and they hear what's funny. And so there'll be laughter during the Scripture reading as people hear what's really in the Bible, and then it helps us hear it differently. But we want and need to be part of the Mennonite Church. We want to contribute to the church. And so as we tried to discern where it should be, our history and connections are deepest in Portland. And they were willing to receive us as members on this occasional basis.
Marlene, in all of this journey, did you ever figure out what the importance was of foot washing?
Yeah, I did. I've used that story from Portland Mennonite Church about the reluctance to wash feet. I've used it many times in classes. There was a time at Portland where we stopped washing feet because these sophisticated, rational 30-somethings thought, well, the idea is we're supposed to be servants, right? So why do you have to do it? Why do you have to do this disgusting thing? But we were overlooking the power of symbols and ritual and action. And something powerful happens to people when they actually kneel down and wash someone else's feet. So, yeah, I discovered that it was important.
I'm Al Lind. In your movement from the first half to the second half of spirituality or your life, whatever your story, are you still in a struggle in that transition? Or tell me just a little bit about that transition and where you are now with that movement.
That's a good question. Maybe there's something beyond the second half. because what I'm deeply aware of now at this stage of my life is how helpful the first container was, how inadequate it was for me as an adult, and how wonderful it is that there are such amazing and creative teachers and scholars and observers of the cultural scene, all kinds of resources to expand one's understanding of the world and thus of God in the second half of life, and especially to the contemplative tradition that brings one to the center, to the core. And the reason I said at the beginning, maybe there's something, a third stage, is that there's less and less that needs to be defined carefully at this stage. It's pretty simple. It comes back to this little motto from childhood. It's about God being love, and that love is flowing in the world, and we are invited, amazingly, to be part of that flow of love. And so in some ways, it's very simple at this stage.
I'm reading the book by David Brooks, his most recent book on Road to Character or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he begins a book about the same idea, but he calls it Adam 1 and Adam 2. But what are the resources available to us in the Mennonite Church to, first of all, be aware of this whole phenomena and then to be nurtured in it?
That's another good question. What are the resources? Those were seeds I was trying to plant throughout my life, teaching people spiritual practices, introducing people to the wide range of examples and teachers in the Christian church, not just our own special teachers, who are very important, and we never want to lose those. But there's wisdom out there beyond our circles. And so there's, in many ways, there's no lack of teachers. I think what's required is a small group of people who will be together and support each other, and that would probably be the most significant thing that any of us needs. We're part of a small group in our current church that meets every other Monday afternoon for, we share communion together. They don't sing much, unfortunately. We share our faith lives and our questions and discernment with each other. And I was commenting on that, how important that group is, with our pastor not long ago, and she said, well, if every member of the church were in that kind of small group where you focus on your spiritual life, she said the church would be healthy and vibrant. That's one answer. That's not all the answers there are. But that's what I've needed through the years, is a small group of people that I can meet with who will open their lives to each other and let the Spirit move in that setting. Is that, am I responding? Okay.
One more.
Marlene, I remember you talking a little bit about Julian of Norwich when I was honored to take your class. So could you speak a little bit more about what you mentioned about her and how her writings helped you sort some things out about your witness to violence or suffering?
Julian of Norwich is my favorite mystic. She's been my spiritual mother since I found her in my early 20s. She was an anchoress who lived in a cell at the church in Norwich, spent her life praying and providing spiritual direction for the people there. But she had a series of visions in which she saw the crucified Christ, and in her vision had conversations with Jesus on the cross. And she wrote down those visions, and then she meditated on them for 20 more years and went back and rewrote the visions, incorporating what she had come to understand in those intervening 20 years. And that would answer many of our questions if we could have a conversation with Jesus on the cross. I mean, she's asking him, what does this mean? Why are you here? What were you doing? Who are human beings in relationship with you? And the Jesus she met on the cross is who tells her how much he delights in his relationship with human beings. It's a relationship of love and delight. And there's this deep wisdom that she gains from that conversation, that all will be well. All manner of things will be well. That's the famous quotation that you hear in many places. And if we have that deep trust and faith that all will be well, I think that's what sustains us in places of suffering and violence and in the midst of peacemaking. This deep trust in God's creative, redeeming work in the world, and that God is about making all things new. That's what the cross is. Jesus didn't come to the earth to die. Jesus came to bring life, to bring abundant life. The story is the resurrection story. The dying is part of what we all experience. We die and we rise. But Jesus didn't come to die. Jesus came to bring life, and that's what Julian heard in those visions. And that was a correction to an understanding I had as a child. If you think Jesus came to die, then there are a whole lot of other things that follow from that, including that I'm a poor, terrible, guilty sinner, which is true on the one hand, but it's all part of the dying that then leads to the rising. The rising is the point. There'd be much more one could say about Julian.
Thank you, Marlene. It's been a real pleasure having you here. Now we briefly move to the business portion of our annual meeting. Jerry, would you begin with a treasurer's report?
Marlene, I'd like to make a correction. to your early statement about being married after you finished your school. My wife and I were married on Friday night and graduated from college on Monday morning. And May 20, it will be 50 years. I want to welcome each one of you to our annual meeting today. We've had a challenging year, but with God's grace, we may overcome many of these challenges. As you have already noted, we have changed some of the officers in our society. Don Bacher, our longtime treasurer, became president, and I switched with him and became the treasurer of the society. And it's my hope I can fill his shoes as treasurer. Fortunately, he set up our accounting records online, which are a lot easier, and so forth. My report to you as members of the society consists of two parts. First, as you see in the first page, it is the balance sheet, and the second page and the third page continuing is a statement of income and expense. Let's look at just briefly at the balance sheet. The balance sheet shows the current value of our building, which, as you see, is approximately $235,000. That is the archives building that sits here at the grounds of Zion Mennonite Church. That's the largest asset we have. It also shows that we have a balance of $5,600 in our checking account, and that is the sum total, basically, of the assets of the society. This balance is a real concern to our board of directors and to myself, since it is our source of funds to keep the doors open and to carry out the work of the historical society. The second part of my report is the statement of income and expense. During the past year, we have had an income of around just approximately $5,800. Half of the income came to us from contributions and memorials. The other half came from, in fact, less than half of the income has come from dues from those who have been participating members. And we may want to consider how that might change. During the past year, we had a deficit of $2,356. And it's obvious to all of us that we cannot continue unless we come to some conclusions as to how to generate more revenue and so forth for the society. The expenses have not been excessive, and I've been one who most of my life have been in the accounting field in one way or another, and so I've looked hard at our expenses, and I have to tell you there isn't a lot of fat in that expense side. Essentially, we have the larger expenses are insurance on the building, liability and property insurance, utilities, keeping the building warm so people can do their work, and mailing costs to mail our semi-annual letter, including printing, have been the largest centers of expense for us. I would like to take this opportunity to encourage you to help us do the work of the Pacific Northwest Mennonite Historical Society. You can do this in three ways, I'd like to suggest. First, I urge you to pray daily for the board and the volunteers of the society. We're doing work the Lord has called us to do, and we need that source of strength. Secondly, please consider adding the society to your tithing list. It can be regular. It can be once a year gift. But we do need to have income coming to keep doing the work that we're doing. And so in your packet or in the program that you've been given, there are two forms. One is a membership form. If you are not a member of the society and you would like to be, there is a form that you can complete and send with your check for fees. The second one is a contribution form. And you can tell us if you want to pledge a certain amount each month, you can do that. The address to send is my address. Just send them to us, and we'll go from there. The third way you can help is to add the society to your will as a beneficiary. Marlene didn't say so, but her father made a significant gift to the society, and it basically helped us finish up the building, and we appreciated that. If you have any questions about estate planning, we do have resources that we can use to get you an answer. The fourth thing, is that our membership have decreased. I went through our list of long-term people, and I realized how many people I knew who were no longer living. And that is a concern because we're not getting some of the younger people that we should. So if you know of somebody who might be interested, let Don know or let me know, and we'll get you the information to become a member. In conclusion, I wish to thank each one of you who have maintained your membership and have made contributions during the year to the society. My biggest thanks, I think, is to those who have given their time as volunteers on a daily basis, or in our case, mostly on a weekly basis, one day a week at least. So any questions or questions of clarification? Okay, Don.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm. No, not on a regular basis. We do once in a while, but not on a regular basis. No.
This works easier for me. Thank you, Jerry. President's report. First of all, I'd like to thank each of you for being here today again and for your continued support of the Pacific Northwest Mennonite Historical Society through your membership and your individual contributions. Without your support, we would not be able to provide the archival and research services to you, your congregation, and others within our conference and throughout the United States. As this is my last meeting as a board member, I'd like to make a few comments about my time on the board. October of 2006 was my first meeting as a member of this board of directors, a little more than 9 years ago. Much has changed for the organization in those 9 years. When I joined the board, we were the Oregon Mennonite Historical and Genealogical Society. Now we're the Pacific Northwest Mennonite Historical Society. You would have thought we could have made it a smaller name. But it's a name which more reflects who we really are and who we really represent. In 2006, we were located in a very small room, I call it a closet, on the campus of Western Mennonite School. We had more materials collected from churches, Mennonite organizations, and families than we had space to process, display, or even store. When I came on the board, a fundraising effort was well underway to build a new facility that would become our new home. because of the generous financial support of you and many more, on October 22, 2012, we dedicated the Pearl and Ivan Krupp Heritage Center just across the way on this campus. Since its opening, the volunteer staff has been busy sorting through the many records received from congregations, Mennonite-affiliated organizations, and families throughout the U.S. and Canada. And we are slowly adding our collection to the National Mennonite Church USA online archive. Now that we have space, we are able to provide for those who wish to do research into their family or congregational history. Our new facility has an extensive library containing over 2,600 books. We are also able to provide workshops and other small group events. We hosted Shirley Showalter for a book review of her autobiography, Blush, A Mennonite Girl Meets a Glittering World, and in October this past year, a workshop entitled Your Story Matters was led by PNMHS Secretary and Conference Historian Gloria Nussbaum. Much has changed in the past 9 years, and with those changes have come a variety of opportunities. The Pacific Northwest Mennonite Historical Society has the opportunity to reach out and serve many across our conference, our denomination, and the world at large. As we receive materials for our archive, they are being added to the electronic databases supported by MCUSA, which makes them available worldwide. Having our own building provides us with the opportunity to host workshops and gatherings of persons with special interests. We are now able to host public school groups, college and seminary students, retirees, and many others as we share our Mennonite heritage and family histories. The changes we've experienced over the past 9 years has also brought with it serious needs. When we were housed at Western Mennonite School, our expenses were few. My first year as the treasurer, we spent $2,721.66. This basically covered office expenses, speakers for the two meetings we held during the year, some travel costs, and printing costs for the newsletter. This past year, our expenses were over $8,000. Having our own building has brought the added fixed expenses of utilities, insurance, fire, and security and accounting costs. $5,000 of that $8,000. You've already heard this once today, but this means your financial support is more important than ever. Please fill out the contribution card in your program and leave it in the box over here as you leave today. And if you're not a member, we encourage you to fill out the membership form and leave that there as well. Finally, a few needs I would like to see filled over the next few years. First of all, I would like to see the PNMHS board expanded. We need a few more younger persons on the board. PNMHS needs younger ideas and younger energy. I would also like to see representation on the board from other states in our conference. Currently, we are a conference-affiliated historical society, but we're made up primarily of Oregon board members. I would like to see that change. Number two, I would like to see the PNMHS membership expanded to include more members from conference and non-conference churches outside of Oregon. We have members from other states, but the majority are still from Oregon. PNMHS needs someone to serve as an event coordinator. And I'm talking to all of you people here too, so if you have an interest, let us know. This person would be responsible for seeing that meetings such as this happen. I would envision this person actively pursuing opportunities to expand the visibility of PNMHS through interest workshops and learning opportunities. I would see this person as the organizer and facilitator and not necessarily the person that did all the work. And finally, PNMHS desperately needs a grant writer. With the added financial needs of the organization, grants would greatly improve the work of the archive and its financial support. the staff and board would be better able to focus more on the services that we provide rather than worrying about keeping the doors open. Martin Luther King Jr. had a dream. So do I. My dream is that the Pacific Northwest Mennonite Historical Society continues to grow and prosper, that it is able to infuse itself with new blood and new ideas, that it continues to build on our heritage. Thank you all for allowing me to be part of you these past 9 years. Okay, now, before I recognize those board members that will be leaving the board and the new board members coming on, I'm taking my life in my hands here, but I'd like to recognize a very special person. In 1987, the Oregon Mennonite Historical and Genealogical Society became an official nonprofit organization. For more than 28 years, this organization has had the services of this very special lady. In fact, she is the organization. She helped create OMHGS, for many years served as its secretary, and for many more years has been its official archivist. Margaret, would you stand up and let us honor you? Margaret has also requested that she be allowed to retire, and we're working really hard to make that happen. Okay, leaving the board this year are Goldie Hierley and John Gingrich. Goldie, stand. Everybody knows who you are, but and John and Louise would be here, but John has grandpa duty today. Goldie began her board service in July of 2007, and she came on the board as the vice president and has been that ever since. John and his wife Louise have been a part of the society for a long, long time, as serving as volunteers in the office over here. But John joined us on the board last year for a one-year term. We thank them both for their leadership. Okay, the new persons that will, or the, I guess there are the rest of the board that will continue as members of the board, and I'm going to ask you to stand as well. Vice chairman is Ray Kaufman. Secretary and conference historian Gloria Nussbaum. Treasurer Jerry Barkman. Board member Melanie Springer Mock. And Pat Hirschberger is also on the board. Thank you. Okay, finally, one of the duties of the membership is to affirm the board's recommended list of new board members. This year, the board recommends that you affirm the following persons. And I think only one of them may be here today. Mike Barber. Mike is from the Eugene Church, and Mike has agreed to assist Margaret in being part of the archive staff. Lynn Rush. Lynn is here. And Carolyn Gingrich. And Carolyn has agreed to be the librarian for us. So those are the three new people that are coming on board. Now, as membership, if you are a member and you affirm these new people as part of the board, would you stand? Thank you. And I have to say it, if there are members who do not affirm, would you stand? I'm never sure why they always do that, because who would want to stand at that point? Okay, so your job is done, and that concludes the business. Okay, I have asked Stan if he would come and lead our final song. Yes, Ray.
Is there going to be a tour of
just
the archives?
I'm getting there.
I'm sorry.
I'm getting there. So I've asked Stan to lead our final song, and that is number 3. 3:28 in your hymnal, O God, our help in ages past. Following that, are there folks who would like to visit the archive building up the hill here? We will open it if there are people that are interested. I figured you folks would be. Okay, so following the singing of the hymn, you will be dismissed. If you have filled out pledge cards or memberships, please drop them in the box, and we'll open the building up the top. Stan?